Oh, Annie, no, she says. You delivered your speech beautifully. It was my mistake for thinking it would be enough. There are just some wounds that run too deep for words to heal. Atreus adds heavily, and the anger of the people can be often cruel and ill-placed. Today, you paid the price for wrongs you didn't commit. Wrongs you didn't commit. Atreus can't know how those words implicate me, though it's clear that Annie does. Her shuddering shoulders shift on his last words, her back twisting, as if to turn herself from me completely. Though no one else notices, I perceive the movement as if she had shouted, "Get out." I begin to back toward the door. You behaved in every way befitting a guardian, Antigone, says Atreus. Thank you. Annie's shaking shoulders go up to her ears. Is there anything else you require, Protector? No, you and Dorian may go. And Antigone, please take any time you need before returning to class. Your superiors will be notified. Annie and Duck rise. Annie passes me in the doorway as if she can't see me at all. When they're gone, Atreus shifts his gaze to me. So, you've heard the problem. If you were the administrator, what would you do? I realize at last why I'm here. To play pretend. Atreus has done this with me before, though this time it's with a village whose particular history I have pondered for the last 8 years. I would call off further morale visits to the Highlands, I tell him, and leave Holbin alone. Good, says Atreus, nodding slowly as if we're in class. Why? Because the coming war will teach them what we can't. Palor and I arrive at Wayfarer's Arch early. We wait for Julia among the moonlit crags in the stone clearing of the ancient dragon perch, mounted atop an arch of cast that rises so far above the moonlit North Sea that the waves look, from this height, like still water. Palor throws himself onto the stones at the ledge like a cat curling into its bed and lowers his head onto his crossed forelegs to wait. I sit beside him, looking out over the dark, cast-studded sea, scratching under the joint of his membranous silver wing where it often itches. He ruffles his wings and shifts his weight closer, uttering a snort of contentment. You like it up here, don't you? I murmur. I like it up here too. It's easier, looking out over a view like this, to revisit the welcome Annie received in Holbin. The sight of her stricken, tear-stained face and the exhaustion that set in afterward. I've watched Kallipolis transform year by year into a better place than the one the old regime left, and still, the old wounds are so easily reopened. The wounds the Dragonborn left behind. The wounds my father left behind. How does the thought still have the power to make me light-headed this many years later? Palor nuzzles the back of my head, which I've lowered onto my knees, and I reach out to notch my fingers between his horns and hold, like I'm on the deck of a swaying ship and he's the rail. I lift my head at the whisper of wings overhead. A passing shadow across the stars makes Palor and me lurch to our feet, his wings cock half opened, tensing as another dragon circles in descent. Julia's storm scourge is mid-size for an adolescent, unusually slender, her wingspan exceptionally long. It's impossible to make out in the night how she handles, though I find myself irrepressibly curious. When they land on the opposite side of the perch, Julia slides off her back with fluid comfort, and the storm scourge eyes Palor curiously, her horned tail lifting. Palor paws the ground, shifting weight from side to side, as if to compensate for the fact that she is almost half again his size. Easy, Julia and I both say at once, though Julia says it in dragon tongue. Erinys, meet Palor. Palor, Julia repeats, testing it. We watch Palor and Erinys approach each other like skeptical but curious dogs, sniffing and sidestepping. Julia muses, her mouth twisting. Palor, the Aurelian who chose a storm scourge. I wonder what she makes of that. The virtues of the old houses and their dragons are shorthands we've grown up knowing. Skyfish House, known for their moderation and mercy. Storm Scourge, for their discipline and strength. Aurelian, for their judiciousness and learning. She must look at Palor and wonder what was lacking in me, and what found, that I was passed by the Storm Scourge and chosen by an Aurelian when I was presented to dragons. When Palor and Erenice have circled each other and parted again to stare from a distance in what seems to be a mutually agreed upon ceasefire, Julia turns to me. "Hello again, cousin," she says in dragon tongue. As she approaches me on this moonlit night, it's easy to see what a tavern booth concealed. The seabird's detritus of broken shells crunches and cracks beneath her boots at each step, her cloak streaming behind her on the salt spray wind. Julia walks with the unmistakable air of a storm scourge, confident, poised, with a lingering note of danger that persists even when weapons are laid down. A brooch of Highland heather, the symbol of Storm Scourge House, clasps her cloak at the breast. Everything about her that should be intimidating makes me feel at home. "Did you like my letter?" she asks when we stand feet apart. "Our fathers may be dead, but their blood runs in our veins. We were born to this." "Yes, it was beautiful. Like something out of the old poetry." Julia smiles thinly at my choice of words. "You didn't find it compelling?" I look at our two dragons eyeing each other at a distance as their wings, ever so slowly, ease back into resting position. I think of the fantasies that have danced across my vision since I read her letter, of Julia and I, side by side, on dragonback, taking back what is ours. The kind of narratives we explored in play as children. But now, we should be old enough to know better. For us, dragons may have meant glory, but for most everyone else, they were what Annie experienced today. Something to be feared, hated, and at the soonest opportunity, spat upon. "I find reality compelling." Julia scoffs. "Fine, let's discuss reality. Our fleet will attack soon. We intend to make this a war and we intend to win it. We will not be sparing." The girl from the drowned dragon, familiar and full of sad understanding, has vanished. The new Julia is fierce, her businesslike tone enough to make my blood chill. I hear my own voice take on coldness and issue the conclusion that is really a question. "Your fleet hasn't sparked yet. This is an idle threat." For a second, we just stare at each other. And then she tosses her head back, lets out a laugh of abandon, and breathes a word. It takes me a moment to understand that it's a command, and it's for Erenice. Erenice lifts her head like a wolf to the moon and fires. For a brief blinding moment, sparked dragonfire warms the night like a beacon. Palor rears, reverses, and for an instant I feel his intimidation twist in time with my own sinking heart. Erenice lowers her head and watches his retreat, cool and confident, her tail flicking idly back and forth across the stones. At a distance of 10 meters, Palor bares his teeth and growls. The acrid smell of dragonfire lingers sharp on the air. "It's all right, Palor." I turn to Julia. "How long?" Julia shrugs. "A week or so." "Congratulations." She is smirking, an eyebrow lifted. "Thank you, cousin." "Just Erenice?" Erenice is likely to have been the first. Sparking tends to spread hierarchically among fleets, from higher-ranked dragons to lower ones. Julia only smiles at that question, as if to say, "Do you really think I'm going to answer that?" "Are we really such an idle threat, cousin?" she asks. "Even if it were just Erenice, one sparked dragon is enough to level a town. What do you have right now? Pikes and shields?" Her words wash over my rising incredulity. Level a town? Does she hear herself? "Julia, this is madness." The coldness has been stripped from my voice as the desperation hits. "Thousands of innocent people will die. You quote the old poetry? You must see that these are the kinds of mistakes that brought down the Aurelians, that finished the Dragon Lords. You can stop it. This stops me short. If you turn and help us bring this usurping regime down from the inside, none of those deaths need to happen. If you keep rising, to First Rider, maybe to Protector, you can hand it over like a plucked fruit. I take a step back from her, and shells crunch beneath my boot. To turn was a request I'd expected, but to betray from the inside is a step baser than I'd even considered. You balk, she observes. Why? As if of my own accord, my arms open, my palms spread. She studies me with cool grey eyes. They've raised you, she surmises. More than that. You believe in their vision, she realizes. Her voice is cold with disgust. You believe they're better, even after everything they've done. You'd be loyal to the man who betrayed us. I lift my shoulders, lower them. I think there's more to this than questions of vengeance and birthright. A strange bitter smile twists Julia's face. The moonlight glints silver on her dark hair, on her cloaked shoulders. I was warned that you might feel this way. What exactly about Atreus's vision do you find so appealing? His generous but ill-implemented meritocratic process? His efforts to rewrite the past with his censors? Do you think it's noble that he lets peasants vie for First Rider? She rides well, I grant, our little Highland serf. Julia's disdain drips on her words like acid, and I recoil from it. Our rings in my ears, the casual possessive of storm scourges discussing land holdings. The other finalist is not our anything. Julia's voice lashes her response. And you are not naive. Wake up. You think his regime is better because it calls serfs by another name and teaches them to read? Maybe it is. For now. In a time of plenty, without pressure or strain. But watch and see how that vision splinters when we exert pressure. Then we can revisit whether you think it's noble. Whether you have the stomach for more. Exert pressure. The possibilities for interpretation there are open, but the purport is clear. Pressure will come in the form of violence. For a moment there's no sound but the girls crying sleepily from the edges of the cast. When? I ask. Julia tilts her head back, rakes her hair back from her face, and smirks at me. Don't look so worried, cousin. The first time will be just a taste. Her tone is playful. A mockery of the tone she used to adopt in the garden when she was teasing. What does a taste mean for someone who speaks so casually of leveling a town? I look out over the edge of the cast at the flattened sea blurring a reflection of the stars and reach for words out of a sudden feeling of emptiness. With nothing but the ocean to bound it, the dome of the dark night feels infinite. Julia, what have you become? It seems I'm not the only one who's troubled by the distance. Julia speaks first, her voice softening to a murmur as she changes the subject. Do you want First Rider so much you can taste it? The moonlit cast comes back into focus, and with it the silver outline of my cousin with her streaming hair and riding cloak, her feet planted on the rock beneath them like she owns it, as she waits for my answer. Do I want to breathe? Do I want to eat? This has been a dream in the fabric of my longing for as long as I can remember. Less a desire than a need. I've lost everything else from the old life. But this I can keep. This I'm still allowed to want. Yes. Of course. Julia nods, relieved by the strip of common ground that we still share. That's how it was for me too. That's how I won. Good luck in the final tournament, Leo. I pray to the long-dead gods that it brings sense to you.
Chapter 8. The Lycian Ball. Annie.
There's a time after my morale visit to Holbin when the world goes dark. I remain in bed for hours, skipping meals, refusing conversation. Your father would be ashamed of you, girl. Would he have been? My father died a year before the revolution. When I search through the handful of memories that I still have of him for an answer, I realize that I remember him too poorly to know. Annie? Lee's been asking about you. Chris's voice rouses me from a half-sleep where I've been lying in bed, cocooned beneath the covers and willing my own existence to stop. For a moment, all I can think of is how it felt when Lee used to hold me. Warm and safe. The only thing that could make the crying stop. But not now. Not for Holben. Tell him I'm fine. I won't be that child anymore. I can do this without him. And eventually, I do. I get out of bed, brush my hair, eat a meal. The world slowly returns. Patrols, training, classes. I'm not assigned any more morale visits, and in the wake of Holben, I can't say that I wish otherwise. Propaganda now avoids visits in parts of the countryside that have particularly fraught histories with dragonfire. Overshadowing our usual obligations is the Lycian Ball's approach, our last public event before the first rider tournament and Palace Day. Though we remain tensed for the Pythians' first move, the Ministry has determined that this tradition, at least, should proceed as planned. Eventually, it feels like every spare minute is filled with its preparations, fittings, etiquette sessions, advanced dance lessons. Though in most ways it's a welcome respite from worse pressure and darker thoughts, it's not without its own kind of stress. Especially when, in advanced dance, I'm told to pair off with Lee. As the Guardians will be the Lyceans of Honor for the event this year, the finalists will lead the opening dance. The dance instructor tells us as we stand in the vaulted grand hall the Lyceum uses for ceremonies. His accent has traces of dragon tongue, his tunic trimmed with delicate embroidery, more fashionable in the old regime. Shouldn't be too difficult for either of you since you're both so light on your feet. The instructor moves on to prepare and position the other practicing partners, leaving silence in his wake. It's strange to stand so close to Lee after hours spent listlessly in bed, relearning how to do without his comfort. But the person I remembered comforting me in the orphanage bears little resemblance to the one I stand beside now. Shoulders full beneath his uniform, toned from years of training on the Eyrie, tall enough that I have to tilt my head up to look at his sunburnt, wind-chapped face. This is a boy who eats until he's full, who reads into the night, and spends summer days on dragonback. Although on closer inspection, Lee's grey eyes are lined in a way that I didn't remember them being before my morale visit. Have you started training yet? I ask. Lee looks startled. For the first rider tournament? I nod, thinking of Power's offer to train and my refusal. The compliments like insults, the words that cut because they hit home. You probably don't even want you to win, he said. I haven't spoken to Power since. Lee shakes his head. Not yet. Will Lee bother to train, I wonder? Or will he just assume with that same confidence that leads him from class to rounds to training with such grace that first rider is his for the taking? Before the morale visit, I thought my ambition would make Holben proud. Now I know better. Whatever history I make as a dragon rider, they have no interest in. Those words that I spent bedridden hours trying to unhear. Your father would be ashamed of you, girl. For all I know, the widow was right, For all I know, my family would have had no interest in my ambition either. It's a relief when the instructor's voice pulls me from my spiraling thoughts.
You're all familiar with the standard waltz by now, he tells the class, standing in the center of the polished floor. Today, we're going to work on a slightly trickier variation.
Lee emits an exhale of understanding. The Medean, he murmurs. His eyes have lit with the beginnings of a smile as he watches the instructor assume position with his assistant. I'm sorry?
It's a waltz.
The instructor explains.
One of the oldest dances across the dragon birthing sea. The Medean waltz has long been a favorite of the airborne courts. It was designed to imitate a dragon in flight.
At his prompting, partners join together. Lee extends a hand palm up, and I place my fingers over his. His other hand goes to the small of my back. Although it's a position I've practiced with other dance partners before, never until this moment have I felt the intimacy of being held here, the center of my gravity, where his slightest pressure lights every nerve of my body, and my only instinct is to respond. I've watched Palor be calmed by this same hand, this same touch, light but firm, for the last 7 years. The instructor goes on.
The Medean is faster, syncopated, more expressive than the waltz you're used to, and harder to pull off. But when done right, there's nothing more beautiful.
Lee adjusts, bringing me closer, clasping my hand more firmly in his, craning his neck to track the first few demonstrated steps that the instructor models with his assistant. We stand so close now that my gaze is level with the neck of his uniform, the shadow where his throat meets his collarbone. When I realize I've been staring at it, I jerk my face back and up to look at his. Why are you smiling? I mutter. I'll turn to imitate. Lee exerts pressure and I move to his touch. The step is long, the catch delayed so it snaps a forceful turn. I feel the delight of its motion the way Ayla delights in a dive. Lee studies my face and his smile softens. For a moment, his expression contains something that looks like longing.
That's right, Lee's got it, the instructor observes, moving between us.
Lee is holding me close enough for his breath to brush my ear. That same easy confidence that I was moments ago, contemplating in bitterness, is now turned on me like sunlight.
Because this one's fun.
The next half hour is a blur of motion and lightness guided by Lee's touch, and it leaves me with a spring in my step for the first time since Holborn, and a lingering warmth in the small of my back where he held it. In addition to the general lessons offered to the rest of the corps, the Fourth Order riders also receive special etiquette instructions. Lee, Power, Corps, and I attend a private session in one of the small conference rooms of the Ministry of Propaganda, conducted by Miranda Hayne herself. I haven't seen her since my morale visit. Good to see you, Antigone. How are you? From the way she asks, I realize that she's remembering how we last parted. When I was, the thought makes me cringe, making a report to the First Protector while crying. But she speaks with a warmth that feels genuine and without condescension. I'm better, thanks. Hayne smiles, then moves to the center of the conference room to address the group as a whole. Cor and I have taken a seat. Lee stands with arms folded, and Power lounges against the side of one of the tables looking bored. Hello, everyone, and thank you for coming.
She goes on to explain that after the Lycian Ball's dinner, the four of us will be introduced to some of the most influential elites of the class Golds individually. This is your first official public appearance as future leaders of the city, and you four will be of particular interest as candidates for next protector, whom the Golds will take part in choosing. Unlike the other metals, Golds are not just your subjects, they're also your constituents. At Hayne's mention of the protectorship, Power flashes a brief, crooked grin. Cor looks a little alarmed. Lee's expression does not alter at all, and my stomach sinks. The upcoming First Rider tournament has been a daunting enough prospect without adding this. New ways to be evaluated, new hoops to jump through, more people to impress. At least in the arena I have Ayla. "We urge you," Hayne goes on, "to make a good impression. Regardless of what your personal political ambitions may be, it's critical to put your best face forward, especially during these uncertain times. You've paid morale visits to the class bronzes, irons, and silvers. Now is the time to reassure the class golds." She gestures forward her assistant, who's been waiting at the side of the room. "To that end, let's rehearse." The introductions are highly formalized, a script that we're expected to master and perform. We'll be paired with ministry escorts, who will introduce us in Kalish, but we practice the dragon tongue variation as well, in case any guest changes the language. Hayne drills Kor's pronunciation of the dragon tongue phrases repeatedly, until he's flushing with embarrassment, but can produce them a little less harshly. When Hayne works with Lee, she has to remind him not to mutter his dragon tongue and then compliments him on his accent. Power produces the phrases in both languages with great flourish, and Hayne seems torn by disapproval and amusement. When it's my turn, she introduces me to her assistant, who's impersonating the third party. "And it will be polite in your case to curtsy, Antigone." As soon as I do it, Power lets out a snicker. I look up. Hayne's face is clouded and Lee's gone red. "Not like that," Hayne says softly. Confusion makes me struggle to defend myself. "This is how my mother..." I stop, understanding abruptly. I begin to color too. "Like this," Hayne says simply. "This is how you'll do it from now on." She demonstrates. It's strange to watch someone curtsy in trousers. Hayne's neck remains erect. The motion is slight and airy, and contains none of the sweeping obeisance that my mother's curtsy did. I imitate, wishing my face would stop burning, wishing Power would stop smirking, wishing Lee would stop staring at the floor. Hayne proceeds with the role play. "May I introduce?" I need no prompting to produce the phrases that I've watched the other three practice before me. But when Hayne prompts a switch to dragon tongue, I cannot stop my face from lowering in shame. "From the stomach," Hayne reminds me. I say the dragon tongue again at full volume. It sounds alien, my own mouth producing the language that I'm so much more comfortable hearing than speaking. I can hear the sound of the Kalish accenting my words, rough on the phonemes that, for a native speaker, would sound flute-like and liquid. I wonder whether here too, Hayne is cringing at a peasant's lingering crudities. But instead she says, "Excellent." For the female guardians, there are also fittings, dresses occasioned for the first time in years and commissioned by the ministry. I pass the session at the dressmakers with my tongue thick in my mouth. The fabrics that they're asking us to choose between are luxurious enough to delight Deirdre and Alexa, but leave me speechless with unease. Chryssa, who seems to straddle the other girl's delight and my discomfort, stays by my side and keeps up a steady stream of commiserating commentary to put me at ease. Oh, these city dresses are so fancy, aren't they? My family would never dream of going to dressmakers this nice. And I appreciate it, though I don't tell her that the idea of going to a dressmaker in the first place would, to my family, have been unfathomable. We're assigned colours by squadron, but the cut and textile are left to our choosing. Chryssa worms preferences I'm surprised to find I have out of me while the dressmakers are in the back room, then demands them on my behalf when they return. Having a dress you feel good in can make all the difference, Chryssa tells me sagely afterward when I attempt to thank her. I don't really understand what she means until the night of the ball. Then, barricaded in the girls' dorm, I pull on the dress that looks like something out of Duck's Book of Fairy Tales and allow Chryssa to arrange my hair. When Alexa passes me the mirror she smuggled in from her home on the Janiculum, I take in my appearance with surprise. It's strange to see that with the right kind of clothing and hair, I don't look like someone who would ever have been called a peasant. Almost reflexively, I pull my shoulders back and stand a little straighter. Deirdre and Alexa are letting out shrill exclamations of delight, and for once, I don't mind. Even Orla, lying on her bed and reading as usual despite her ball gown, takes the time to glance over the top of her book and give me a thumbs up.
Our Annie, all grown up, Deirdre says to Alexa, wiping an imaginary tear.
Chryssa takes my hand to spin me toward her. The half step of a dance, and I let out a laugh of startled delight. At the sound of my laugh, she presses her finger against my lips like she's pausing something. That's it. That's the face you need to wear. Smile the whole time, Annie. Show those wrinkly old golds how much fun you're having. That'll impress them more than anything. I haven't told her any of what Hayne said to us in the private session for the Fourth Order. But maybe Lee or Cor did. Or maybe Chryssa just guessed. When we join the boys in the solarium, I hesitate on the threshold. It feels ridiculous to be wearing a formal gown in front of people who've never seen you in anything but a military uniform. But then Duck appears in front of me.
Annie?
I let out a half-embarrassed laugh. He wears the same delighted expression he once turned up to a starry sky when he insisted I see it. Warmth fills me. Surely, this is a gift greater than any other, to be able to enjoy the world so openly, without apology. Not bad yourself, I tell him, and Duck laughs, patting his own wet-combed hair with a sheepish grin. And then, amid the sparkling of dresses and the black mantles and the sprinklings of laughter, I feel the eyes of a single person on me from across the room. Unlike the others, he stands perfectly still, waiting for me. I kiss Duck on the cheek, like Chryssa might have done, except for once her exuberance suits me too. Then I turn and walk across the floor to Lee. Hey! I feel a foreign boldness coursing in my veins as I stand in front of him and we look at each other. I take in the sight of Lee in dress uniform, so suited to it that he seems dangerous. And I take in the cool, liquid tension, like discomfort but not quite, that comes with the feeling of his gaze on me. Better than the last dress you saw me in? The last dress he saw me in was a shift approaching rags. I hear myself make the Albans reference as if someone else dared it. Lee's smile becomes a grin. He lets out a soft laugh. Much better, he agrees.
And still, his gaze is on me. Surprised, like he's just realized something and is pleased by it. I feel the pitter-patter of recognition, of those eyes, that face, all the more familiar in a dragon rider's ceremonial uniform. But for this one moment, I refuse to acknowledge it. The palace clock tower is tolling the hour. It's time to go. Lee turns his elbow ever so slightly away from his body, and though it's not a gesture of politeness we've been taught, I understand. He's offering me his arm. Heart in my mouth, I take it.
Lee.
Even though all our training and security measures since the sighting have been implemented under the assumption that we'd be going against a sparked fleet, I've still, in the wake of meeting with Julia, felt uneasy. Unable yet to make any report that wouldn't arouse suspicion, I've been advocating for higher numbers of patrols along the northern coast, with a greater number of guardians manning each one. But when it comes to the night of the Lycian Ball, my request for additional precautions is overruled.
It's been weeks, we've seen nothing, and Atreus wants all of you there, Holmes tells me beforehand, during our meeting in his office in the inner palace, lined from floor to ceiling with maps of the Median, of the North Sea, of Callipolis. For all we know, they're not even sparked. For a moment I consider telling the Minister of Defense that I know better, but I'm fairly certain this man, this hero of Palace Day, would drop his avuncular tone pretty quickly at that news. Not an option. I'm only safe and only free to act as Lee Sur Palor from Cheapside. So I bite back the answer that I can't give and deliver the one I can. I thought the policy is to plan as if they are sparked. Holmes gives me a hard-eyed stare, then lets out a bark of appreciative laughter. I like how you think, Lee, but it's just one night. Try to enjoy yourself, all right?
By the night of the ball itself, I've almost persuaded myself to listen to Holmes. As we make our way to the Hall of Plenty at sunset, its lingering warmth enough for the breeze to feel like a caress, the tension left in me from Julia's threat slides reluctantly away. It's hard, on such a night, to remember fear, especially not with Annie's arm folded in mine. She lingers beside me as we make our way through the palace to the Hall of Plenty, and her continued presence is something I marvel at. Duck walks a few paces ahead, sucked into conversation with Rock and Lotus, though occasionally he twists back to look at us. Each time he does, his eyes find and fixate on Annie. I can't tell if she doesn't notice or is just acting like she doesn't. Though the occasion has changed, much about tonight's feast feels familiar from the old days. The elegant figures making their way to the candle-lit Hall of Plenty, the sound of muffled laughter within echoing in the courtyard without. As a child, I used to wander here with my cousins and siblings after dinner, throw rocks in the ponds surrounding the statue of Pytho the Unifier, and climb the marble dragon's back to touch old Pytho's nose. Pytho is gone now, destroyed in the revolution, but his dragon remains. Outside the hall, ministry officials are pulling aside guests who will make up the opening procession. The Lyceum graduates, followed by the guardians according to flight ranking, and finally the professors of the Lyceum, robed for the occasion in their academic caps and gowns. I can hear the sound of hundreds of people inside, talking, laughing, waiting for the meal to begin. Annie, standing beside me at the rear of the guardian section, sucks in a breath and then exhales. I turn to look at her, and as I do, I can't help taking it all in again. Her gown, a burnished Aurelian red, settling just off her shoulders. The curls of auburn hair arranged atop her head in an elegant cascade. The pale expanse of skin between, rippling with the burn scars of a dragon rider. She's at once as beautiful as what came before, and something else entirely. Something powerful. The women of the old order have been surpassed, and so too has the cowering child I once met in an orphanage. But I take in her expression and realize that, absurdly, despite her transformation, Annie is still intimidated by a fancy dinner. You're nervous? Annie nods. I don't exactly belong in there, she mutters, smiling grimly. I wonder if I'm imagining that she puts an emphasis on I.
Annie.
Stained glass sparkles high above, stone pillars as broad as the tables themselves rising to support a vaulted ceiling shrouded in smoke from the fires that line the hall. Candlelight warms the faces turned toward us, sparkles on jewels and gowns, and glints on the golden wristbands on every wrist. I am aware of the eyes of the hall on us as we make our way down the central aisle. Our seats, along with those of the other members of the Fourth Order, are at the high table. Once everyone is seated, Atreus rises.
We are gathered today to celebrate the accomplishments of those Lyceans who have completed their education and are now entering our society as colleagues. Some might wonder, in this time of crisis, whether such ceremony and celebration still has a place. To them I answer, now more than ever. On the brink of war, we do well to remember what we fight for. We do well to remember that Kallipolis has a future that shines brightly, and these young people deserve a better world. The graduates we honor today will not only inherit the world we leave them, some of them will be on the vanguard fighting for it. Tonight, in a very special edition, we also welcome the 32 guardians who have reached the final stages of their training. Lyceum graduates, please rise when I call your name.
Atreus proceeds to read from a roll, the student's name, their specialty, and, where applicable, their government posting. After about 40 young men and women have risen from their seats, scattered up and down the long tables that fill the hall, they are applauded and sit down. Atreus proceeds.
Will the guardians of the 32nd Order please rise when I call their name?
He begins with the lowest ranked of the Dragon Riders, whose ranking was determined in qualifiers before the public tournaments began. Their names are followed by Draconym instead of surname, and modified by Dragon Breed. After the riders of the 32nd Order have been listed and applauded, Atreus proceeds to the 16th. Lotus and Deirdre are among those who rise. Then the 8th, those who made it to the public quarterfinal. Duck, Rock, and Chrissa are among them. Chrissa's squadron leadership is noted after her dragon's breed. Then the 4th. Power Sir Eater, Stormscourge. Core Sir Morana, Stormscourge squadron leader. And finally, Atreus says,
last but not least, our finalists for first rider.
Antigone Sir Ayla, Aurelian. Lee Sir Palor, Aurelian squadron leader. The applause is, by now, shockingly loud. I can feel it thrumming through my chest, sending tingles up my spine. Lee is staring hard in front of him. Atreus nods to us. We resume our seats at last, and he raises his glass.
To the future!
We raise our glasses and drink. My mouth has been uncomfortably dry for the last half hour. I'm surprised by how pleasant my first taste of wine is, like grape juice but richer. I take another sip and Lee leans over.
It's strong. Don't use it to quench your thirst.
I nod, but can't help thinking that if my mouth keeps drying out at the rate it has so far, my throat might just close up. Lee takes in my expression and frowns. He twists and makes a minute gesture at one of the servants moving along the table, who swoops down at once to hear Lee's request. An iron wristband, I note, with muted discomfort. Around us, roast goose is being sliced and served. Steaming vegetables are being piled on plates. Lee tells the servant, "Water for the table, please." The servant bows. "At once, milo-" He catches himself. Lee smiles politely, not acknowledging the slip. And the servant backs away, embarrassed. I take a gulp of wine on purpose. Aside from Miranda and myself, there's only one other woman at the table present for reasons other than marriage. A steel-haired, middle-aged woman with jewels glittering silver against the warm gold complexion of her neck. When Atreus introduces her as Dora Mithridates, I realize I know about her already. For various reasons related to a dead husband and an inherited financial empire, she's one of the most powerful citizens on the Janiculum, an honorary alderman on their council, known for investments that were critical to getting the revolution off the ground. When she speaks, it takes a moment to figure out why I don't understand her right away. Then I realize she's speaking in dragon tongue. Hayne drums her fingers on the table, lines appearing between her eyebrows at the sound of the language. She glances at Mitt Hartley, the chairman of the censorship committee, who lifts his eyes to the ceiling. The foreign minister, Legio Simac, and Dean Orthos, head of the Lyceum, smile almost guiltily. Holmes's forehead wrinkles like he is passing.
"Kalish, Dora," Atreus chides gently. "Many of our guests don't speak dragon tongue."
Dora humphs and reverts to heavily accented Kalish.
"Including your four guardians, I take it? I've noticed that no riders from the Janiculum made it into the Fourth Order."
"I'm from the Janiculum," Power says.
Dora, who is sitting next to him, pats a ring-crusted hand on his arm.
"You'll forgive me, boy. I mean to say Janiculum blood. Patrician blood. You are adopted, are you not?"
Power blanches. Cor chokes on his wine and nearly spits it out. Even Lee has to hide an inhaled snort that he turns into a cough.
Adopted?
Power, who spends all his time lording his birth over commoners like me. Power gives Lee and Cor a look of venom, the colour of his cheeks deepening nonetheless. And when he catches me struggling to keep my mouth in a line, he juts out his chin, glaring at me. I hide my smile in my wine glass and return my attention to the adults, who have noticed none of our exchange.
"I thought we were agreed," Atreus is saying to Dora, smiling with the strained patience of an old argument. "That blood is precisely not how this regime would select its elite."
"You mistake my point,"
Mithridates answers promptly.
"I have no classist complaint to make. My concern is military."
General Holmes's eyebrow lifts with a look of incredulity, but he continues slicing his goose without engaging.
"Oh?"
Atreus asks, with reservation.
"With regard to your sparking problem?"
Holmes puts down his knife.
"Madam Mithridates, there is no sparking problem."
Mithridates snorts.
"You need dragonborn blood to spark your fleet. The patricians have dragonborn blood in them. Too many generations of intermingling not to. All I'm saying is, if you had a few more patrician riders..."
Hayne and Atreus look at each other, expressions not entirely masking surprise, seeming to be silently conferring. Stefan Orthos, the Dean of the Lyceum, responds first, his tone irritable.
Yes, I know that theory is all the rage right now, he says, but there's no science behind it, Dora. Just misapplied literary criticism. The Aurelian cycle is a work of fiction, not a military manual. Whatever people down at the club are saying.
Orthos does not notice how his words generate another exchange of glances between Hayne and Atreus or its alarm.
I'd like someone to please explain to me this theory that the Lycians are discussing in their club, says Holmes.
Holmes is, I realize with a start, the only exception to the class gold guest list. Either consciously or not, he flicks his wrist as he speaks, so that his sleeve covers his silver wristband. Hayne speaks first, her tone hesitant.
As I understand from my research department, the theory Dora refers to is one that's cropped up on and off over the years and found a small resurgence recently because of the pressures on our fleet to spark. The usual blood supremacy argument about dragon-riding families based on the Aurelian cycle. Because it depicts dragon lords as godlike, the theory would say that there's a blood difference, a blood superiority, between the dragonborn and their subjects. Of course, it's a completely unsubtle reading of the text. There is distaste in Hayne's tone.
And how is that? Mithridates asks icily.
Lee's voice is quiet, but he has no difficulty drawing the attention of the table, even though he's speaking for the first time.
Because the hubris of the first Aurelians was their downfall. You could just as easily read the Aurelian cycle as a condemnation of the Dragon Lords.
Lee nods at Atreus, acknowledging the interpretation that we have discussed in class, and then adds,
You could even read it as a condemnation of dragon riding itself.
This last part is an extrapolation Lee seems to have made on his own. Atreus's still face flickers as he studies him, the briefest trace of surprise. But Hayne, nodding wordlessly in Lee's direction, doesn't notice.
In recent months, the theory has taken on new elements in certain circles, she explains, claiming specifically that dragon-born blood is tied to dragon bonding and sparking. It's all completely unfounded, but the problem is, of course, that sparking itself remains such a mystery. What causes it? How to trigger it? We don't know. In any case, I'd thought, here Hayne gives Dean Orthos a questioning look, that the blood superiority theory had only fringe popularity, and that most of its proponents had been apprehended by the re-education committee. I would not have known it is all the rage down in the club. Orthos shifts in his chair. He is a middle-aged man, greying, venerable, even when wearing an academic cap. At her glance, he is suddenly full of discomfort, as if realizing that what he'd assumed was common knowledge was, in fact, something he has just, in fact, divulged. When he speaks, his tone is apologetic, appeasing.
Well, you know how it is, Miranda, he says. Conspiracy theories find fertile ground where people are frightened.
Hayne takes this observation with a gracious nod of her head.
That is undoubtedly true.
And then, when she looks up, it is at Hartley, the chairman of the censorship committee, who has not yet spoken. He returns her gaze with matching gravity. Though neither speaks, it's the first exchange in this conversation that actually alarms me. Hartley's committee determines what literature to restrict, ban, or confiscate,
An exchanged glance with him has the power to change a library's contents. Dora Mithridates has turned to Lee.
I take it you are studying the Aurelian cycle? Where are you from again?
Lee's lip curves. Cheapside.
So, you have learned dragon tongue in school?
There is unmistakable skepticism in Mithridates's tone. Lee nods.
Well, you discuss the work very comfortably, for one who lacks a native appreciation for it.
Hayne actually lifts her eyes to the ceiling in exasperation. Atreus is watching Lee and Dora with a look of muted curiosity. The corner of his lip has lifted in a mild smile. Lee nods and inclines his head, graciously accepting what Dora seemed to intend as a compliment. Then he smiles and answers in dragon tongue. This is our work. This is our labor. It's a quote from the Aurelian cycle. I recognize it because we translated the line a few weeks ago. Lee has changed it slightly so that the line makes sense in context. His accent is perfect. Kor and Power swing around to stare at him in surprise. Lee has always been notably unwilling to contribute during Dragon Tongue class. The rest of the table, who have already been watching him, are shifting and exchanging glances. Atreus looks from Lee to the faces turned to him, picks up his wine glass and takes a drink. Dora's eyes are still on Lee, though she speaks to the first protector instead.
I see what they're talking about, Atreus.
Lee.
As dinner progresses, I grow more and more tense. I'm beginning to feel as though at every turn I'm about to expose myself. Their hubris was the Aurelian's downfall, and it will be yours too if you keep showing off. But this room, these people, this setting, spurs me to a recklessness that only a conscious effort at self-control can contain. After dessert, Atreus rises and offers annual awards of accomplishment to class golds who have made significant contributions to Kallipolis. Recognition is given for civic virtue, for technological and economic innovations, for military service, academic research, and artistic achievement. Lotus's father, Lotiran, is awarded the title of Kallipolan Poet Laureate. When he rises to receive the laurel Atreus presents, he turns out to have Lotus's same wiry hair and lanky build. In the half-hour break before the opening dance, the Fourth Order riders are taken around the hall to make introductions. Miranda Hayne escorts Annie, General Holmes takes Kor, and Dean Orthos takes Power. Atreus escorts me. The conversations I have at his elbow with class golds around the room soon run together.
Lee Sorpalor, pleased to meet you at last. We've heard so much about you.
That's kind, thank you.
Training up for the First Rider tournament? Between you and me, you are our favourite finalist. Mustn't let us down, my boy. Not with these Pythians on our backs.
The man's voice is conspiratorial, the we seemingly referring to the golds generally, whom Atreus has informed me he represents on the Gold Advisory Council. I give my answer, smiling, though my thoughts are of Julia and her urging to betray, and to Annie, on whom this man's praise casts oblique aspersions. Of course he has no way of knowing, as he confides between you and me, with a dragonborn, the irony of his preference. He also has no way of knowing that as I look at him, I recognize him. Not from rounds in the new regime, from court in the old. Because while the small talk required by Atreus's introductions is not difficult, ignoring the disconcerting familiarity of many of the faces is. What would Julia say if she saw me shaking hands with the people who betrayed us? But I already know the answer to that. Her answer would be that we should make them pay.
Annie.
Miranda Hayne turns out to be the one who will accompany me around the hall making introductions. It doesn't ease my nerves.
but I've been replaying the lines of introduction in either language over and over in my head for the last few days and know them cold. I'm startled when one of the first couples I'm introduced to, middle-aged and greying, beams at me. "You, my dear," the man says, squeezing my arm, "are the light of the nation. This is what we once only dared to dream of." I thank him, a little unnerved. As we move away, Haynes smiles. "The Bertrands were some of our earliest supporters," she tells me. "But they're not all like this." When Haynes introduces me to another of the guests, a towering elderly judge who serves on the Janiculum Council, he regards me with unchecked amusement. His tunic is long, intricately embroidered, and, like many of the vestments tonight, reminiscent of the old regime.
"So, this is our Highlander rider."
"How do you do?" I say, curtsying. Instead of bowing or even replying, he turns to Miranda.
"Only a trace of a Highland accent," he remarks with admiration in dragon tongue. "And she's clearly been given a good scrubbing."
I can feel a flush blooming across my chest where it would usually be hidden beneath a uniform. Tonight, in the scooped neckline of my ball gown, it's exposed. When Haynes doesn't crack a smile, the man wilts and switches to Kalish.
"It was just a joke, my dear Miranda. Sometimes it seems one can't make them anymore."
Haynes looks sideways at me, as if to see if I have any rebuttal. I think of Lee, pulling out a line from the Aurelian cycle in dragon tongue for a table of onlookers. But as at the Lyceum Club, when I stared down power and realized words had fled me, I have no such rejoinder. When Haynes realizes I don't, she makes an exiting remark and steers us on. I am still nauseated with shame as she introduces me to the next set of guests. Once would have been enough, but they keep coming. These compliments that feel like insults, the airy condescension that purports itself as kindness. When I'm introduced to Darius's parents, who turn out to own a shipping and trading company that takes up half of Harbortown, they actually turn away from me while I'm still mid-curtsy.
"Is this her?"
By the time this voice finds us, I'm so exhausted that I turn only with reluctance at the sound. The man is younger. In his mid-20s, his tunic simple but well cut. It takes me a moment to realize what I noticed about his voice. A Highland accent.
"Declan," Miranda says, with unmistakable relief.
"Yes. Antigone, may I present Declan of Harfast, a junior advisor to the First Protector, and one of the youngest members of the Gold Advisory Council. Declan was among the first graduating classes at the Lyceum."
"How do you do?"
Declan grins. He's fair-haired, long-faced, lanky like an overgrown teenager.
"Surviving," he says. "They eaten you alive yet?"
I let out a startled laugh. As soon as I do, I worry I shouldn't have. But when I look over at Miranda, her mouth has quirked.
"They're just jealous of her brains," Declan tells me. "Don't pay them any mind."
Instruments have begun to tune in the back of the hall. The open space in the center of the floor has cleared. Guests are gathering on its edge. Miranda nods to me.
"It's time, Annie," she says. "Time to get up in front of these people and perform."
My gown was designed to be light for dance, but all the same, as I weave through the crowd to find Lee, I find its crimson folds hindering and the skin of my chest and back feel bare. The excitement I felt at the beginning of the night at my own reflection has died.
I miss my uniform. I find Lee on the edge of the floor. To my surprise, he looks as drained as I feel. His face is pale in contrast to the dark of his dress uniform, his grey eyes flat and unseeing. "How was it?" he asks. I just shake my head. "Yeah," Lee says, exhaling. "These people." There's something more than distaste in his voice, a latent anger approaching fury. It is, for Lee, almost unprecedented. When he realizes I'm looking at him, he composes his face at once. As accustomed as I am to wondering at all the ways this life comes more naturally to him than to me, I'm startled to feel myself swept by sudden compassion as I understand something I should have seen from the start. Of course, Lee has reasons to find tonight hard too. Probably even harder than I do. I think I surprise both of us with my next words. "It's almost over, Lee." Lee's eyes meet mine, searching. Then he takes my hand in his, and together, we step away from the crowd.
Lee.
Annie's fingers hold mine tightly as we assume position, her brown eyes fixed on mine as though determined not to look anywhere else. I could count her lashes, the freckles across her cheeks and shoulders, her burn scars shining in the candlelight, the red of her dress blending in color with her hair. For a moment, the room is silent, the eyes of the guests trained on us. And then the music starts. I've known since rehearsal that the melody would be one I know, but it's not until this moment in the echoing vaulted hall, surrounded by the glittering gowns and formal wear, that I feel the ache of it. The sound of a single violin, the notes throbbing like a human voice and then rising up higher, impossibly high, painfully beautiful. The memory of this dance, another night, another life, my mother and father and sisters, and a world that was their birthright, a world that's lost, and all that's left is a handful of revenge-bent survivors on a rock in the North Sea, and this room full of the people who betrayed them. Annie's hands leave their position and circle my neck. The slight pressure is enough for her to bring my face down to look at her. Her eyes are wide, clear. Her gaze seems to see me, see everything. "Stay with me," she whispers. I reach up with a single hand to take one of hers down from my neck. At the cue, I step forward and Annie responds. Now it's my turn to keep my eyes fixed on hers, to forget everything but the sound of this, my parents' melody, my parents' dance, and the sight of Annie moving with me, the feel of her waist against my hand, and the pressure